Here's one way to think about the Trump administration's trade and energy policies. Go back 30 years. That's about it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today. This one is the 5th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with the dulcet tones of one Lawrence Kudlow, better known as Larry, currently the director of the National Economic Council, talking about a conversation he had with his boss, the President of the United States, yesterday. Here you go.
He is very seriously contemplating kind of a shift in the NAFTA negotiations. His preference now, and he asked me to convey this, is to actually negotiate with Mexico and Canada separately.
He was speaking this morning, I should say, on Fox and Friends, but with the observation that we are a year plus into the NAFTA renegotiations, here's Marketplace's Aaron Schrank with a little bit of detail.
Without NAFTA, what would U.S. trade relationships with Mexico and Canada look like?
The short answer is it's very unclear what would occur.
Jeffrey Gertz, who teaches at George Washington University, says splitting the trilateral NAFTA deal into separate bilateral agreements might mean closing down North America's 25-year-old free trade area.
You could imagine a world where we sort of get rid of NAFTA, but we still have a generally open trading agreement, in which case we're trading under WTO rules.
Which means the U.S. would treat the two countries the same way it treats other World Trade Organization nations that have no separate trade treaties with the U.S. Canada and the U.S. did have a free trade agreement before NAFTA. Laura Dawson at the Wilson Center's Canada Institute says it could take over in NAFTA's absence.
But it's a really old deal. It predates a lot of the things that are part of the modern economy.
So Canada would want a new deal. Dawson says it would prefer a multilateral one, in part because at this point it's just easier, but
if they got an offer they couldn't refuse, in the Godfather sense from the United States, they might be tempted to say, okay, we're going to let the U.S. and Mexico fight it out.
Any new deals would face pushback from businesses that have been making decisions based on NAFTA rules for more than two decades, says Mauro Guillen at the University of Pennsylvania.
So it's going to require quite a bit of time for companies to adjust.
The administration's new approach to NAFTA is sure to come up when President Trump and Larry Kudlow visit Quebec for a G7 economic summit this week. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
It's going to be a tad awkward at that G7 summit up in Quebec that Aaron mentioned, not least because NAFTA is not the only point of trade unrest between the United States and Canada. Don't forget steel and aluminum and tariffs thereupon. We have talked to a bunch of people running companies here about what those tariffs might mean. Today, somebody up there, Paul McGraths, the president of JEM Strapping Systems in Ontario, Canada. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tell me what JEM Strapping does, would you, sir?
Well, what we do is we take cold roll steel, we slit it, we deburr it, we edge roll it, we paint it, we wax it, we oscillate it into 100-pound coils or jumbo coils, and then we sell it to industry. We sell it to U.S. industry, we sell it to Canadian industry. Half of my purchases are Canadian steel and the other half is U.S. steel.
It occurs to me, Mr. McGraths, that you're going to get whacked on both sides, tariff-wise, right? You're going to feel the effects of the tariffs that Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland announced a couple of weeks ago, 25% on American steel coming north. And then also you're going to feel the effects of President Trump's tariff, 25% on Canadian steel going the other way.
That's correct. We're hit from both ends.
Tell me what your thoughts are, sir, about this whole trade, discussion is what the White House likes to call it.
Well, I see it as a big loss for Americans because American steel mills, their biggest customer for exports, Canada. And in Canada, the United States has basically shut themselves off from steel from anywhere in the world, pretty much. The United States is not self-sufficient in steel and actually needs Canadian steel for American manufacturers to make whatever they're making. And they're going to be deprived of enough steel to make what they need to make. I see it as a huge lose-lose for Canada. I see it as a huge lose for the United States and Mexico. You know, we should all be working together.
You've got a U.S. division, right, with a certain number of people working down here. What's going to happen to them, do you think?
Good question. Probably going to put American people out of work. Can't supply them. How am I going to supply them? I can't bring U.S. steel into Canada without getting hit with 25%, and I can't send Canadian steel to the U.S. without getting hit with 25%. So it means unemployment for some nice-paying jobs in the United States.
What's the long run on this one, Mr. McGraths? After this blows over, with whatever end result happens. What's the long-term impact?
Long-term impact is Canada and the United States have had a very special relationship. Americans are very concerned about security. We are your northern security. We're part of NORAD. We're part of the U.S. military complex. We're your best partners and friends. But you don't take your best friend and poke him in the eyes and hit him over the head and then hug him up and say, hey, support us. It's destroying the relationship with your most important allies.
So when you go down to the coffee shop, sir, and have a cup of coffee in the morning or you're at the supermarket in the afternoon or whatever, what's the conversation about these tariffs?
Well, the Canadian feelings are betrayal, insult. And I talk to a lot of Canadians through all the provinces, and I talk to a lot of Americans. And a lot of Americans don't understand why they're doing this to Canada. I understand why you want to do it to China. China's been very guilty of dumping steel into Canada and in the U.S. and so forth. But Canada is not China.
Paul McGrath.
I don't know.
He's the president of Gem Strapping Systems up in Ontario, Canada. Mr. McGrath, thanks for your time, sir. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We are now up to 16,000 exemption applications on file with the Department of Commerce. Companies looking to get out from under those steel tariffs, 2,000 aluminum exemption requests. And in our reporting on low those many requests, we have found a common thread or two.
We've spent, you know, tens of thousands of dollars on our legal fees already.
That was Charles Smith. We talked to him yesterday. His company makes tire cord.
It's a deliberately cumbersome process.
That is Kate Carroll. She's of counsel at Butzel Long in Detroit, Michigan. They have been working with some of their clients on those tariff exemption applications, suppliers to the car and truck industry mostly. She spent years as an in-house lawyer at one of the big three car makers, so she knows her tariffs. But still, she says, this stuff just takes time.
This is not a space that you can just say, oh, I'm a lawyer here, I'll fill it out for you. You really have to understand the whole background of where these tariffs are coming from.
It's anybody's guess, Ms. Carroll says, as to what's going to happen.
Now I think what's happened between the, you know, drying up of the country exclusions and this sort of lack of progress, I think, of anybody that has filed for an exemption. And, you know, I think it sort of proves the point, our hypothesis, that they're not looking to give out a whole lot of these.
Those applications, by the way, are going up online at regulations.gov. They are there for public comment, should you care to do so. On Wall Street today, pretty much a wash. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, now to energy policy. The Trump administration has been upfront about wanting to save struggling and in some cases failing coal and nuclear power plants. The latest effort was made public by the White House Friday night, a presidential directive telling the Department of Energy to put a lifeline in place. It's kind of a complicated rescue plan. Power grid operators and other key parts of the system say they were blindsided, but at least one thing seems clear. There could be, if this plan goes through, big changes come to the market-based supply and demand electricity networks we now have. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong is on that one.
The market for electricity is hard to grasp. So let's talk about buying and selling apples instead of power. Today, in about half the country, apple sellers who can't compete go under. Energy consultant Susan Tierney is with Analysis Group.
If I'm an owner of a merchant plant in Pennsylvania or in Ohio or New York, and I am not the cheapest to operate, I'm not going to run and I'm not going to get paid.
That's happening for many coal and nuclear plants. They're shutting down. But the administration wants to save them on grounds of national security. How? Michael Panfil at Environmental Defense Fund says it's like the grocery store forcing you to buy government apples at government prices.
There is no substitutable product for electricity. So you are essentially faced with a mandate to purchase this more expensive, this government-mandated power before accessing the rest of the market.
Today, an Energy Department official said the plan is still in the works and it's fluid. This is the administration's second try at this. The first got voted down by bureaucrats. If it goes through, economist Gurjan Gulen at the University of Texas Austin says wave goodbye to electricity competition. He says the government already subsidizes wind and solar. And now?
This will be the end of the competitive markets as we know it. This is a continuation of a trend, a domino effect.
Affecting consumers. By one estimate, prices would go up by $4 billion to $11 billion every year. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There was a report out today from the Johns Hopkins University School of Education about high school graduation rates. They are up an all-time high of 84% for the 2015-16 school year, which is great, except for this. Increasing numbers of those high school graduates are showing up at college needing to take remedial courses. So given that, from WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris examines what a high school diploma is really worth.
Short answer, not as much as it used to be. That's because it's easier than ever before to meet the requirements for one, according to Bruce Fuller, a professor of education and public policy at UC Berkeley. He says in the past, a high school diploma was essentially proof of a certain skill set. But now we have what he calls diploma inflation.
As the meaning of the degree thins out, that signal becomes very blurry and very hazy for employers.
There's pressure on school districts to raise graduation rates. An easy way to mark success is through standardized tests. But an emphasis on testing coupled with shrinking budgets has resulted in thinned out curriculum. Barbara Radner with DePaul University works with teachers in Chicago public schools.
Our kids enter ninth grade below ninth grade. So the teachers in high school wind up in ninth grade teaching perhaps seventh grade. And that just keeps going. So when they're seniors, they are perhaps sophomores.
So it's true. There are more graduates, including more Black and Hispanic students. And in some cases, credit recovery options help. In the old days, if you failed a class, you went to summer school. Now students can take online classes and get back on track. Mike Hansen is with the Brookings Institution.
There is just much more of an opportunity for just not doing the work or not doing the work in a very rigorous way.
But even with lowered standards, a diploma means lifetime earning potential is still greater than for those who leave school without one. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
There's room for confusion for consumers about what they're really seeing when they see listings information on the internet.
Yeah, there is room. Real estate data ain't all it's cracked up to be, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 13 today. That's less than a 10%. Ended things at 24,799. The NASDAQ gained 31 points, about 0.4%, 76,37. S&P 500 up a point, less than a 10%. Basically steady, 27.48. Coffee chain, Starbucks, dipped 2.4% today after Howard Schultz announced yesterday afternoon he is stepping down as executive chairman. Twitter flew up 5%. That on news, it's being added to the benchmark S&P 500 stock index on Thursday. The social media company replaces Monsanto, which will officially become part of the German pharmaceutical giant Bayer. Yes, it is Bayer, although write in if you like. Bank stocks moved down in line with falling bond yields. Bank of America was off 0.9%. Citigroup bustled down 0.8% today. Bond prices, well, they rose. Thanks for asking. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.92%, and you're listening to Marketplace. We heard from Catherine in Bellingham, Washington the other day, who says she finds great value in how Marketplace explains things like tax reform and how changing fiscal policy affects our lives. If you agree with Catherine, please join her by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to Catherine and all the Marketplace investors who make our work possible. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. President Trump has made no secret of his main beef with the current state of our trading relationship with China. The trade deficit that we have with Beijing is his own personal economic monster under the bed, despite most actual economists not being especially worried about it. There are a whole lot of reasons why we import so much more stuff from Beijing than we sell over there, but there is one area of this economy where China is trying really hard to import more from us. academic talent, and that is raising alarm at some of America's top universities, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
If you stroll around the campuses of China's top universities and research facilities, you may well bump into someone like this.
Chuck David, assistant professor at Tsinghua University School of Medicine.
Foreigners. David is an American. He studied at Duke and Columbia and Sloan Kettering in New York. He's not the only foreigner at his school or even his department.
In biology or life sciences, we have a British guy, someone from Spain, and an Italian woman who ran a lab at Yale for a while.
Thousands of them over the past decade have moved and set up shop at top Chinese universities and research centers. This is more than simply a sign of China's growing ability to pay for talent. It's part of a broader policy by the Chinese government.
There is a strong interest in recruiting faculty from abroad.
Michael Powers is a professor of finance at Tsinghua University School of Economics and Management. He was at NYU Stern School for 20 years before that. He says he was offered a competitive package to move and says China's top institutions, the government, and private foundations are willing to spend what it takes.
The universities in China have to be competitive with international salaries. So one way or another, they will put a package together to attract the foreign faculty.
In some fields, salaries can, as a result, meet or exceed what a professor could make in the U.S. The central government and regional governments offer stipends and support to foreign faculty and researchers. Some programs offer health insurance, housing subsidies, and money for faculty's children to go to private schools.
It actually covers a lot of things. So it's actually fairly important that I got it. And, you know, thank God I did.
That's Chuck David at Tsinghua University's medical school. But the reality is, he didn't even know he was going to get those perks when he applied for positions at Chinese universities. There was something else that drew him.
The overall funding climate in China is very good.
Funding for research, graduate students to help him with his research. At his current position at Tsinghua in particular, he says he barely has to write grant proposals at all.
It was sort of a no-brainer.
He says Chinese talent recruitment is not a threat to the U.S. for now. The U.S. still takes in more talent from China than China recruits out. 85% of Chinese nationals who pursue a doctorate in the U.S., for example, are still here 10 years later, contributing to U.S. research, though the Trump administration may shorten visas for Chinese students in certain science fields. Even so, some observers say the U.S. should take notice of Chinese efforts to draw in talent. One of them is Xiaofan Wang, professor of cancer biology at Duke. He also advises the Chinese government on how to make China more hospitable to foreign talent.
Policy right now is not really supportive for people who have the talents to stay.
Wang says NIH funding for biomedical research hasn't increased enough over the 36 years he's been in the U.S. and that it's a crowded and difficult process for researchers, native or foreign, who are just starting out to get funded. The U.S. National Science Board reported in February that China will probably pass the U.S. in research and development investments by the end of the year.
The U.S. still has the best in the world in terms of how the infrastructure, our culture, you know, all the sense, right? But we're not using that because the case that we're not putting money where it should be.
And that speaks to the real reason China is putting energy into recruiting and retaining talent. It's not simply about the educational system or research for research's sake. It's to develop the Chinese economy, specifically to promote innovation.
They need to change the economy, become not just made in China, but created in China. They realize that to compete in the international stage, the key is talents.
Research and innovation are drivers of growth, and for that, you need the best researchers and innovators you can get. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
The Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission had a little get-together with representatives of the residential real estate industry today. A workshop, they called it, but really, it was more like a long-term follow-up. 10 years ago, the Justice Department found the residential real estate industry to be engaged in anti-competitive practices. That's the legal vernacular. Because traditional licensed real estate brokers pretty much had a lock on something called the multiple listing services. It's a critical set of real estate listing databases, which left new kinds of brokerages with pared-down services or strictly online business models struggling to compete. So there was a consent decree, barriers to entry were lowered, and now, 10 years, one housing crisis, and an internet economy explosion later, that decree is about to expire, and Justice and the FTC are taking stock of where things are. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more.
Real estate agent Lou Vivas arrived early to his meeting to put together a gift bag.
There's wine and there's a branded Cutco knife that I give to clients. So people tend to like it. And
it's closing day, one of the happiest days in the real estate business. Buyers get the house they want. In this case, they would be couple Mark Anderson and Tulene Osdegger. The seller gets a check or a wire transfer, and the process is finally over. Getting here wasn't easy. D.C. is one of the tightest markets in the country.
We got outbid several times. Some of them are going way over asking. Sometimes it's, you know, $100,000, $200,000, sometimes even more over asking.
As in many things these days, it was data that set this happy ending in motion. Vivas is a licensed real estate agent, so he has access to the local multiple listing service, the repository for just about everything that's on the market. He set up email alerts for Mark and Tulene so they'd know the minute the type of place they were looking for became available.
I actually remember getting the notification for the house that we bought the morning of our closing on the house that we sold.
That's Tulene, and it was just what they were looking for. 3 bedrooms, 1.5 baths, and a big yard for their 2 daughters. Tulene got her email on a Friday and was at the house the next day.
And then we came back together after the open house to look at it again.
And then we went back again on Sunday to the open house.
Offer made, offer accepted, and a nice commission for Vivas and the listing agent. A familiar story. Surprisingly familiar, given all that's happened to the housing market in the past 10 years. Agents no longer have exclusive access to MLS data, and online sites like Redfin, Zillow, and Trulia are in the mix. Maisie Wong, a real estate economist at the Wharton School of Business, says increased competition should have driven down commissions and other costs.
But if you look at the data suggests that commission rates have not actually changed that much.
They're still stuck at about 6%, far higher than Europe and similar markets. So what happened? Wong says agents may steer clients to deals where commissions are highest, potentially putting low-fee brokerages like Redfin and smaller startups at a disadvantage because sellers are afraid they might lose out.
Because you're very worried that the buyer's agent may not bring a buyer to your house. And that offsets the competitive force of pricing.
Some brokers have also been known to withhold listings from online listing services. Jessica Drake is an attorney at the Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Competition, which monitors the industry.
There's room for confusion for consumers about what they're really seeing when they see listings information on the internet.
That's why the DOJ and the FTC are starting to meet with the industry.
It's been about 10 years since we last took a close look at competition in this space.
And a lot can happen in a decade. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
A lot can happen in a decade, as it turns out, which is why we've got a big project going this year. What's happened in our collective economic lives the past 10 years? It's called Divided Decade, and it lives at Marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, a clever bit of corporate media buzz generation in which I am only too happy to participate. A tweet went out from the verified IHOP Twitter account today. That's the International House of Pancakes. For 60 pancake in years, it said, we've been IHOP. Now we are flipping our name to IHOB. That's a lowercase b. Find out what it could be. It went on 6/11/18. That's next Monday. I personally think breakfast is too obvious. I'm going with blockchain. All right, we're going. Dow off 13 today, less than a tenth percent. NASDAQ was up 31, four-tenths percent. S&P 500, we'll call it basically flat. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Star Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. And I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.